Welcome to Pop Pantheon, the podcast where we completely overanalyze all of your favorite pop stars and then rank them in the official Pop Pantheon. This is your host, DJ Louis XIV, reminding you to please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening to it right now. Follow us on social media at Pop Pantheon Pod. I'm at DJ LOUIEXIV. Merch, like our Niche Legend Dad hat, is available at poppantheonpod.com and our Patreon channel, Pop Pantheon All Access, where we are doing weekly bonus episodes of this show and so much more, is available at patreon.com/poppantheon. Or now, if you want the audio only for those weekly bonus episodes, you can subscribe directly in the Apple Podcasts app. Gorgeous Gorgeous will be happening in two cities. One is a week from Saturday, April 20th at Los Globos in Silver Lake, and one is on May 10th at the Sultan Room in Bushwick. Tickets for both of those parties are available in the show notes of this episode. And Pop Pantheon's own party, Taylor Mania, which is happening the same night as the Tortured Poets Department drops, which is a week from Friday, April 19th, is happening at Parkside Lounge on the Lower East Side. I'll be DJing all your favorite Taylor songs all night. Russ will be in town. If you got tickets to our live show that's happening the following Monday about Taylor, if you didn't, this is your chance to come celebrate with us. Come say hi, come meet me, come talk to Russ, come dance to Taylor music. It's going to be so much fun. I can't wait. So tickets for that are also available in the show notes of this episode. Also on the DJing tip, I've gotten a couple emails from fans recently of the show asking if I would DJ various of their events, weddings, parties, etc. I am 100% here and available to talk to you about DJing your party. Is it your wedding, anniversary party? Do you work for a brand and you're hosting an event? I am 100% available for those kind of inquiries. Let's talk about it. You can shoot me an email at Louis, L-O-U-I-E, at louisxiv.com, and we can discuss it. So hit me up. All right, this week we are doing mailbag episode. We got so many incredible questions from our listeners. You guys really came with the questions. We were completely overwhelmed. We got to a few of our favorites this time. We're talking about Taylor. We're talking about where all the male pop stars are. We're talking about our personal pet peeves when it comes to listening to pop music. There's a special guest appearance at the end of the episode and so many more questions. So this was such a fun episode to tape. If you didn't hear your question on this episode, we actually answered a bunch more of these on last week's Patreon episode. So if you aren't a subscriber and you want more listener mailbag fun, you can subscribe to patreon.com/poppantheon. You can click the link in the show notes of this episode. All right, so here is our listener mailbag episode. Okay, I'm here with Russ. Hi, Russ.
Hi, Louie. I'm on the main feed. Look at me.
I know. I was going to say a rare main feed appearance by Russ. Everybody say hi to Russ. We're here for one of my favorite types of episodes we do, which is the listener mailbag episodes. I find these incredibly fun because A, our listeners are really smart and thoughtful, and man, did we get a lot of incredible questions this time. Like every single email that came in, I was like, damn, like, how are we gonna pick? And also because I don't have to do that much preparation. I feel like I just get to sit here and be thrown questions and get to think about it in real time and talk about it with you, Russ. So this is one of the happiest times stepping to the mic. How do you feel about our mailbag today?
I get so excited every time that these pop in. And one of the things that excites me most is seeing that people listen to the show all around the world. I just opened an email from Norway. I was like, okay, hi, Norway. Mm-hmm. That's so exciting. So yeah, we have some fun and interesting, thought-provoking questions today. And I'm excited.
Me too. What are we getting into?
Okay, we are going to kick it off with the most discussed, perhaps the most anticipated, one of the most hotly anticipated albums of this year in the pop space. It is, of course, Taylor Swift. We have a question from Verity who says, I'd love to know what direction you'd like Taylor to go in for the Tortured Poets Department and which direction you think she'll actually go in. Louis, you are the Swifty on hand. What do you want? Yes. No. Of the two of us.
No. Of the two of us, but like, I don't feel like I should be saddled with the Swifty title and then also savaged all the time for how critical I can be of her. Like, worst of both worlds in every regard.
Well, that is your cross to bear. And listen, we are invested in the world of Taylor Swift, quite obviously. If you have not yet picked up tickets, come to our dance party. You're going to be spinning Taylor Swift songs all night in New York City on April 19th, the day this album drops.
Yes, good plug.
Thank you.
That one in there. Come to the damn party, all right? Like, literally. And I know a lot of you didn't get tickets to the live show because that shit sold out so fast that I know there were people that got left out on that. So here's your chance to celebrate Taylor with us. Like, we'll be there. Like, if you're missing the live show, like, you can literally just come and talk to me and Russ about Tortured Poets, like, directly. Okay, anyway, what do we think Taylor's gonna do and what do we want her to do?
That's right.
We don't know that Jack is producing this yet, right?
I think that we have a solid feeling that he sure might be.
Well, then we're already heading in a divergent direction, I think, from like what I want versus what I think is going to happen. According to Wikipedia, he is not officially credited yet. So I guess we don't have that as fact. I would say that is my number one want, would be Taylor Swift working with new collaborator. I think would be a really important step in the right direction for me. I feel like she's been on for me. Again, everybody is entitled to their own opinions. I feel that she's been on a creative decline in recent years as her commercial success has obviously peaked. And we've talked a lot on the show about how I think some of that is based in the re-recording project, in the way that she's been really backward looking in her musical career over the last couple of years. And I think another really big piece of that is it seems like this moment of her career, this Midnights into Eras Tour moment, has been about maximizing the commercial sleigh. It feels like she has very successfully made music that is broadly accessible and has like played well to the people that have loved her music in the past, and then also people that are like onboarding during the re-recording process. And it feels like Midnight's probably my least favorite Taylor album, if not my least favorite, my second least favorite Taylor album, is, you know, the type of album that seems like it was appealing to a large swath of people but wasn't necessarily like her most interesting body of work for me, or consistent, etc. What I'd like her to do is try something new. I would be very interested in what a Taylor album sounded like with a collaborator that she has never touched before. Maybe somebody that's not such an obvious pop producer. Maybe somebody that could recontextualize what she does well in music that feels exciting or different. Or I don't need Taylor to set the agenda aesthetically for pop music, but I think just something that felt like it was pushing her somewhere new. Again, I don't have like prescriptive ideas about like what that should be, but I would want her to take a swing, I guess, like to try something exciting. In terms of what I think she's going to do, I think she's going to double down on what was happening on Midnights. I think this record is probably going to be produced by Jack, if I had to guess, or largely produced by Jack. I think right now what I can sense from Taylor is, and I don't begrudge her this, I think she is realizing that this is probably like the biggest she's ever going to be. And as this show chronicles in depth, clinging to an imperial phase is fleeting, even for the most decorated pop stars, the pop stars with the most longevity. And at some point, the wheels always come off the bus and things always fizzle out at some point. So I think Taylor is really smart and she knows that. And I think her intention at the moment is to maximize what's going on for her right now. And she's doing a really good job of that. And I'd say the safe bet for her would be to make more Jack Antonoff sounding music that is familiar, that she knows is going to be a surefire hit. I mean, I guess anything she does right now would be a surefire hit, but she's going to do music that probably feels like the most slam dunk down the middle. This album has the potential to be the biggest commercial success of her career because it's arriving at the peak of her success. So I think she's going to try to wring everything out of that that she can. And that's not what I personally want from Taylor Swift, but I understand why she might be doing that. So that's what I think is going to happen. That's what I would like to happen. Again, I have no working knowledge of any of what is actually happening here. So this is totally coming out of my ass. Russ, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
I want to start with something really positive. I was quite negative about the omnipresence of Taylor Swift on our Grammys episode on Patreon. I was really feeling every time that I opened up my phone, I saw Taylor Swift and something that she was doing, either with her boyfriend or with her music, etc. I think that the last 8 weeks or so have been very wisely quite quiet from Taylor Swift. We haven't seen her as present as we have in recent year or in recent months. And I feel ready to take on this album for what it is going to be. I feel
okay.
My heart has opened to this album. It's interesting to see that she hasn't released a single from it. I'm curious if we are even going to get a single.
Well, she didn't do that with Midnight, so.
You have reminded me of this, yes.
Or Folklore or Evermore. Yeah. So, I mean, this is like a theme.
Yeah. The thing that I like the most in Taylor Swift's catalog is Imogen Heap on Clean. And the way that she brought something surprising there in terms of a soundscape for her to live inside of, that really delighted me. And I would love to see her find another collaborator like that, who is still, you know, a pop artist, but is somewhere a little bit left field of the ooey gooey center. That is what I would really like. I also want an element of surprise. I want a new direction. And I also think that this may sound like Midnight's.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
But I mean, we have no way to know that. And Taylor has taken lots of pivots in her career. Like, it was surprising and great when she worked with Max Martin. The first time she worked with Jack was surprising and great. Mm-hmm. Obviously, many people feel affection for the National guy. I'm drawing a blank on his name's contributions to Folklore and Evermore. So it's not like she hasn't surprised us in the past and like tried working with new people. But for some reason, she's very, very comfortable with Jack. And that comfort is understandable, but not particularly exciting to me. So I'm really hoping that maybe even if Jack is here on this record, maybe there's some stuff on here that isn't him. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm hopeful for.
Aaron Dessner is the name that you are looking for.
Aaron Dessner. Yeah. Aaron Dessner.
And as many of our listeners have pointed out, I think that there is a reason that women in the pop space gravitate towards Jack. Obviously, they feel comfortable with him, and that is great. And Jack does produce all different types of music, but they have settled into this sound. And I'm curious to see what else there is, because Taylor Swift has provided us a lot of different textures, and let's get something new.
Yeah. And Midnight's was the most like Jack Antonoff-y Jack Antonoff album like ever. So
definitely. All right. You ready for another question?
Yes.
All right. Our next question is an audio call from Andrew.
Hi, Louis, Russ, and fellow panty droppers. This is Andrew. And I've got a question about the boys in the pop space. I'm wondering what you all think is kind of going on here. It seems like the boys are having a real lackluster year, maybe a couple of years. Harry Styles had a good year last year, and maybe this is just skewed perception because Beyonce and Ariana Grande and Dua Lipa and Taylor Swift, etc., are all sucking up so much oxygen. But it truly feels like there is no buzz surrounding the men in pop right now. I mean, Usher and Justin Timberlake are legacy acts right now who are getting whatever they're doing off the ground, but no one really seems to be that interested. Harry Styles had a big year last year and is kind of on vacay right now, understandably so. But beyond that, really, what is there? Lil Nas X is starting to seem more like a one-hit wonder than anything else. Well, not really, but well, one-era wonder, if you will. And then Shawn Mendes is MIA, Charlie Puth, whatever he's doing, no one really seems to care a whole lot. And then maybe Jungkook's having something, but it doesn't seem to be breaking through into the general pop-consuming public. So what are your thoughts? Let me know. I've been thinking about this for a while and would love to hear what you guys have to think about this. Love the show, obviously. Bye.
All right, Louis, what do you think?
That's interesting. I agree with the premise. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with the premise?
Broadly, yes.
Feels like, yep. I have a like random theory. Maybe you could tell me what you think.
Mm-hmm.
This is like Galaxy, but that's what Mailbag Day is here for, right? Yep. Do you think like the mainstreaming of queer culture has made it such that like what used to be sort of like a subterranean aspect of pop fandom, which was like gays standing women, has become like the predominant feature of pop stardom? And thus the era of the kind of like heartthrob male pop star is kind of receding in favor of a female presenting dominant dominating thing, because even in what Andrew was talking about, like even the guys that have gotten attention recently, it's like Harry Styles, like obviously playing with queer nodding ideas, like Lil Nas X, queer. Part of me's wondering if both queer mainstreaming and then also kind of like in tandem with that, like the mainstreaming of like the main pop girl internet stanny discourse that has like become just like so prevalent in the way we process and think about the pop star ecosystem has made it such that like women are just the centerpiece and like what people think of when they think of pop music these days, and men just less so at the moment. I don't know. That was like one thing I was kicking around in my head. It does feel like pop discourse right now is very dominated by these inherently queer ideas of main pop girl, of pop diva worship, that kind of thing. And I think that that's kind of permeated outside of just queer people. And now that's like the lingua franca of women pop fans. And I think it's also become in like the post-poptimism era, okay for guys to be into like traditionally like girly music. Like I think straight guys feel more permission than ever to like stan Taylor Swift and Beyonce and stuff like that. So those are some ideas that have made me think, like, is this why women are so prevalent as pop stars in a moment where it doesn't seem like there's a ton of like A-listy male pop stars right now? Those are just some ideas that came to mind. I'm wondering what you think.
Well, you know, in the words of Neil Portnow, the former president of the Recording Academy, I think that men maybe just need to step up.
Yeah. It is really intriguing, though. I mean, there's like, when was the last like truly A-list male pop star that like is on the level of the A-list girlies, you know, like Taylor, Beyonce, that crew? Bieber?
Harry Styles. The Weeknd, right. Bad Bunny.
Right, yeah. Right. Bad Bunny.
Part of the answer to this also is the archetype for male success in popular music in this era is not a pop star, but there are men all over the Hot 100. Like,
right.
If you look at the top 10 right now, like Future's a pop star, you know, yeah, up and coming. Right. Benson Boone has been dominating. Teddy Swims has been dominating. Right. Hosier is back.
Right. But I wouldn't call those guys pop stars. When Benson Boone has 7 number one singles, we'll like talk about him being a pop star. But like Benson Boone and Teddy Swims are like fluky TikTok thing.
Yes, but Jack Harlow has had a huge hit that has been stretching out since last summer, Lovin' on Me. So there are certainly men all over the place in terms of popular music. I think that they're just not necessarily gravitating towards doing the type of pop that the women are doing.
Right.
The only thing that I could think of in terms of who might be up and coming and could have this is Conan Gray. Conan Gray has really built a following. I was shocked to see he's playing in Toronto, where I live, a 16,000 person venue this summer. And I was like, holy smokes. Okay. So maybe that is an answer that is coming up. But yeah,
the men aren't like doing the pop
thing,
star thing that we like are used to, really. Like Bieber, I feel like, is in some ways like the last person that really did that kind of classical thing. Harry is doing pop stardom, but he's like dressing it up as this 70s cred leaning rock pastiche. So I'm not saying that he's not a pop star. He obviously is. But I think we have this like kind of traditionalist version of like what a pop diva is, or a pop star is, I should say, less gendered. And there used to be like the guys and the girls that were doing a similar, like Justin and Britney were doing like similar things. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like ultimately. And I feel like we don't have that kind of symmetry going on between like what female artists are doing versus what male artists are doing. It feels like there's not a ton of symmetry there in the pop space. Seems.
Frankly, it doesn't bother me. I'm okay with it.
Me either. I was gonna say, is this a problem? Not really like feeling the problem.
Or are we at a solution, actually?
Yes, right. I mean, listen, I continue to feel sort of bad for what's happened to Lil Nas X.
Yes.
But that's another story.
Another story for another day, which we will cover. All right. Next we have a question about legacy from Bryn.
Hi, Louie. Hi, Russ. I just have a quick question for you. I know you didn't put out a call for questions, but I've just been thinking about this a lot. I really wanted to ask you about artists and legacy management. And the reason why this has been on my mind a lot is because I recently listened to that new Justin Timberlake album. And but it's not just him. I mean, with Usher headlining the Super Bowl and with Madonna going out on her world tour, I've really just been thinking about how most of the artists who I grew up on have molded out of what I would call competitive pop stardom, where they're actively trying to create new fans and be the biggest pop star on earth. And how are more working on shoring up and buttressing up that legacy. And I feel like many, many, many people who have been famous for a long, long time are now, to me at least, the celebrities of my age are now working exclusively in that mold. And I think it's been kind of like a toss-up about how it's going for everybody. So I'm really curious. I want to know what you two think about artists and their legacy management and who does it good and who does it bad. I think a really great example of someone who has like the gold standard for artist legacy management is Dolly Parton. The lady ain't had a hit in years. And I have to tell you, she's as beloved and as famous as she's ever been. And if she got on any platform in the world today and wanted to sing an acoustic version of Coat of Many Colors, I would seek it out and watch it and cry. Like, I just think she's never missed. She hasn't had any stumbles. I think she's somebody who, when she dies, it will be like she's going to lay in state. You know, it's crazy. I think a more contemporary version of this, of somebody who I think has actually done a really great job of this, is kind of Lady Gaga. I think that her switch to movie stardom has kind of been quite adroit, and I think it's done a good job of keeping her celebrity big and reminding us that for all the reasons we love her, there's also all that fucking awesome music. But then there's people like Gwen Stefani and No Doubt, who are headlining Coachella this year, and old JT, who I am not so sure about. I do not think the legacy management is going well. And while I'm still a big fan, I would argue the same can even be said for Rihanna. I saw a ton of not so great critiques of that private billionaire show she did in India. So I just want to know, for the two of you, is there anybody that you think is doing this well? And if so, how? I think it's a really hard and fine tightrope to walk, and watching some of the people I loved most as a teenager fall off that tightrope into an abyss has been interesting. And I want to know if there's anybody you think really kills this and is doing a good job of reminding us why we love them.
This is interesting because I think what this gets into is a really, really tough question, which is like, at what point in your career do you sort of just like give up on being relevant and like just work on shoring your legacy up? And I think pop stars, even really successful ones, like really struggle with that question, because I think it is kind of a hard one. Mm. Because you have people obviously on one side of the spectrum, like Beyonce, who has found a way to continue making relevant music for 25 years and has not settled into legacy artist groove at all, and has had the opposite where she's like continued to seem vital into her 40s and long, you know, into the third decade of her career. So that's like one extreme end of the spectrum. But then I think you have an issue where it's like with most pop stars, I think this is the problem, is that like when most pop stars emerge, their currency is their vitality and their relevance, creating music that feels it's speaking to the moment, that is capturing the zeitgeist, that is like such a fundamental part of like the emergent pop star's repertoire. At a certain point, certain pop stars have a hard time like realizing that that's not what they're doing anymore, or not what needs to happen anymore, or like not what would be the most commercially viable. You know, it also depends on your goal. Like, are you an artiste who just like wants to continue to follow your muse, or are you someone that's like attempting to ensure a commercial long tail that like at some point shifts from zeitgeist to giving people what they liked about you 20 years ago or whatever, and just like making that happen. In some ways, it can be nice to watch a pop star like slide into that early and just kind of embrace it early and like not fight it too hard. I don't know who I'm thinking about would be a good example of this, but like, you know, I think Katy Perry, like in her Vegas residency era, maybe is an example of someone who like, after realizing that nobody thought she was zeitgeisty anymore, sort of just said, all right, like I'm gonna go to Vegas and just like sing my 20 hits that everybody wants to hear. And like, again, we don't know like what she's going to try to do next. Like, is she going to make a play for like a relevant pop album, or is she just going to do like an album that kind of gives her fans what they want? And, you know, we don't know what her next move is. So I think this is hard because I can imagine that the impulse to like stay vital and relevant and like not, and especially because pop stardom is such a young person's game, to not like reach age 35 or 40 and be like, well, I guess my like time doing something meaningful is over, and like, let me just like enter the equivalent of pop star hobby retirement or something like that. So I think this is really, really tough, because then at the same time, if you continue to go for zeitgeist and you're not hitting it over and over again, then you look like a fucking loser and it kind of fucks your legacy up too. Like that's the, I think that's what our caller was kind of getting at. Like Madonna, I think, has actually weirdly had both sides of this coin, where it's like for 25 years, she like defied gravity and continued to feel vital. And then for the last 15, it's felt very much like she's continued to try to stay vital, but it's just made her look kind of silly. Mm. And like, it has had an adverse impact on her legacy. Whereas like the best cycle Madonna's had in the last 15 years, in my opinion, since Confessions, has been this tour, like where yeah. she decided to embrace being a legacy act more or less in a way that she never had before. So it's really, really hard. I don't know the answer totally, because I'm thinking like, who's doing it well? I guess Gaga is a good example of somebody that I feel like is kind of playing both sides, like where she's definitely pandering and like she's done the Vegas show. She's done the like trotting out the Bad Romance era hits. She's become like your parents' favorite jazz slash movie star. But Gaga's also really unique to me because she has this really singular ability to be like 20 different things. Like she's like somehow both like cutting edge avant dance diva and Barbra Streisand and Liza Minnelli. That's unique and weird. So I'm trying to think of like other people that have done this well. I think Usher also has had like a nice, we talked about this a little bit on our Super Bowl episode. Like I think Usher recently has done some good work. Again, Vegas shows seem to be a very clear indication that someone is like embracing their legacy status. I think like that seems to be an interesting parallel here. But yeah, I don't know. Who's doing a good job with legacy management? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, so I think that Usher is a slam dunk. In the recent yeah. years, I think that his ability to generate some buzz around his Vegas show, to have these viral moments with celebrities, that leading into the Super Bowl and what I thought was a pretty good album from a legacy act, has been really incredible in launching him into a tour and cementing the legacy. I think that Janet Jackson has done an incredible job.
Janet, this is the best example.
Yeah, the documentary especially.
Yeah, but I think almost entirely post-Discipline, mm-hmm. like has really spent like the last almost 15 years at this point like really working to like not only shore up her legacy but kind of fix up her legacy in the wake of the Super Bowl, and has like really gone a long way. Mm-hmm. I feel like the conversation around her has entirely shifted in the last 15 years, both by her own doing and by the shifting cultural zeitgeist. But I think like Janet goes on tour frequently and just like gives people what they want, and I think that that's been a really good reminder to people of like what made her great, as opposed to kind of like continuing to try to be the cutting edge artist that she was at one point, which like it's a balance, but like yeah, I think Janet's a really good example.
Another one that I would toss out that has been able to toe the line more successfully than literally anyone else in her cohort is Pink.
Wow.
This yes. summer, Pink yeah, this is
yes,
yeah.
yes.
Pink is touring
yes,
stadiums.
Yes.
And Pink has had an ability, particularly as a live performing act, to continue to hold a spot for herself where Britney doesn't have a spot, Christina doesn't have a spot, Justin doesn't have a spot. I always like to bring up Pink as an example because nobody at the time thought that Pink would have been the one to stick around, but she has, through her acrobatics, through her adult contemporary music, through her collaborations, has constantly been able to keep her name, not necessarily in the main conversation, but in the marketplace. Pink is an incredibly commercial artist. She's a huge success. And the fact that 20 years or so after There You Go, that she is in a stadium, like, come on.
Yeah, Pink is like bigger now than she was at her like actual like centrist pop zenith. Like it's very strange. Yeah. Like Pink in her moment always seemed like B Squad, and now is like significantly more commercially viable than like any of her peers that seemed way bigger than her at the time. And again, it's like that live show aspect of it feels really important. It's like having a really solid live presence. Like I think that's been Pink's saving grace, has been that like she found the acrobatics thing, and like she turned herself into like an A-listy touring act that like did something that nobody else was doing, and it's really paid off. Like I think people that even like don't even care for Pink's music that much like feel interested in seeing her live. Like she has a real live imprint. Like people know what Pink does on stage, and that it's like this really unique thing that nobody else is doing, and that's been like very, very smart, I think, for Pink's latter period success. Like I agree, Pink is like maybe the best example of this. Like, and not to mention that like Pink was having like pretty legitimate hit music like into like the mid 2010s.
Yeah.
She's like kept herself around. Like, yeah, she's done a really good job. I agree.
Okay. That is a perfect transition into our next question, which comes from Dylan.
Hi, Louie and Russ. My name is Dylan and I'm calling from Los Angeles, California. I just wanted to start by saying how appreciative I am of your show and the level of depth and thoughtfulness you provide in your pop culture commentary. Truly, it is really satisfying, incredibly stimulating, and I just have a hard time finding other podcasts that provide such a thoughtful perspective on the issues that they cover. So really, thank you for that. On to my question, though, which concerns a pop star's live performances and concert tours and how they impact their standing in the pantheon. I'm a huge concert goer myself and loved your episode on the best concerts each of you saw in 2023. I also recently finished enjoying your discussion on Madonna's Celebration Tour, and particularly the moments when you contextualize this current tour with Madonna's legacy of pioneering the modern arena spectacular. I myself think that the quality and quantity of a pop star's live performances and tours impact their standing in the pantheon. For example, I believe Beyoncé's placement in Tier 1 has been greatly augmented by her complete mastery of the live performance medium. And I can't help but believe that Mariah Carey, on the other hand, would be much more relevant from January to October if she had Beyoncé's or Madonna's knack for putting on live shows. Other artist tours I feel are essential in their pop legacy and cultural impact would be Lady Gaga's Monster Ball, U2's Zoo TV tour, Janet's The Velvet Rope tour, Coldplay's endless cycle of stadium tours, and of course, Taylor Swift's Eras Tour. However, I find that this aspect of a pop star's career is seldom discussed in your A-list episodes. So I'm curious if, aside from time constraints, if there is a reason for largely omitting a pop star's live performance legacies, and or if you even agree with the underlying premise I put forth originally regarding the impact a pop star's concert tours have on their pantheon standing. Thank you so much for hearing me out and all that both of you do in creating such a wonderful podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you for the question. I don't think it's an intentional omission from that. I feel like when they need to be mentioned, or when I feel like they need to be mentioned, they are mentioned. One of the examples that comes to mind is, I believe we talked about the Blonde Ambition tour during the Madonna series. I believe we've talked a lot about Homecoming during the Beyoncé series we did. So my answer to that question is, I think we talk about them. I don't want to be like defensive about it, but I think we do talk about it like when it feels important. And I'm sure whenever we're covering the current era of Taylor in that series, we will touch quite a bit on the Eras Tour moment. So I'm not sure I totally agree with the premise. I agree that their imprint as a live act is important in the pantheon, but I guess I feel like a lot of that success has to do with things that are built into other parts of the discussion around them. Like, a person's touring success, yes, probably has something to do with their talent as a live performer, but also just is usually a huge reflection of like how commercially successful they're being in other parts of their career. Like, you have someone like Ciara, who's like an incredible live performer, but like, you know, is Ciara, so she's like not exactly like a cultural monolith. So it's not like those two things like are directly correlated. And I don't know, I feel like I'm like quibbling with the premise a little bit. Like, I feel like we do talk about their live performance abilities and like important live performances frequently in episodes, if that feels relevant. We're always trying to like look at what are the most important facets of somebody's pop stardom. And if that feels like an important facet, I feel like it's something that we address.
I have a different answer, and it's more rooted in sort of research and the type of analysis that is available. And I think that we put a focus on recorded music because recorded music is easy to access.
Agree, for everybody. Like, the other thing I was going to throw out there too was like, maybe we haven't seen these tours. I mean, like, maybe we haven't seen these tours. Maybe a lot of other people haven't seen these tours. We try to create this content to be as, like, easily digestible for all the people that are consuming it.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that your take, but particularly on a older artist, say we're talking about a tour that happened in the 80s or the 90s, there is an extent to which we can look up clips on YouTube, that we can read about its success, we can read contemporaneous reviews of the tour, but it is hard to have your own true insight and analysis on something that you did not see live. And it is also difficult with a guest to talk about a piece of media or an experience that you both did not experience.
Yes, exactly. And
so it just doesn't always make for the most interesting conversations.
Yes.
But if we could put ourselves back at the Velvet Rope tour, yes, we would be doing an episode about it.
For sure.
Just the tour.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's really well said. It's like we are trying to take as comprehensive a look at someone's work, but in a way that, like, I feel like tours can often be like a special thing for the people that saw them, but most people don't see them. So it's like, mm-hmm, if it captures the cultural zeitgeist, like Homecoming, like Blonde Ambition, like the Eras Tour have, that feels like important parts of the conversation. But I don't think that there's something that we can, like, dive in and dissect in depth in the same way that we can an album or like an award show performance that everybody sees and that we can access on YouTube, or narratives about them culturally that, like, everybody was familiar with or that got written about or whatever. So just kind of is a little bit of a nebulous territory. And I think we always try to make an effort to discuss tours that feel like they really rose to the point where, like, you can't not include them as part of it. But it's, again, it's hard to discuss, especially past artists' tours, when, like, I didn't see them, guests maybe didn't see them, whatever, stuff like that.
But it was a really interesting question for me to think about. And we are on an ongoing basis looking for ways of covering live music from pop stars, particularly on All Access, and we'll continue to.
Yes, and tours are having, like, an interesting moment right now, it feels.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay.
How good is this episode? It's good, right? Well, great news, because if you like what you're hearing here, you're going to love what we're doing over on our Patreon channel, Pop Pantheon All Access, where for $5 a month, you'll get bonus episodes of our show weekly. You heard that right. Every single week, we're dropping more of the same searing, in-depth combos you love about all your most anticipated new albums by stars like Ariana Grande, Dua Lipa, and Tate McRae, just to name a few, parsing apart all the newest pop singles in our famous new music speed rounds, and of course, diving deep on your favorite classic albums like Madonna's Hard Candy, Christina Aguilera's Stripped, and so much more, all with your favorite Pop Pantheon guests. All this, plus you'll get access to our Discord channel, input on future episodes of the show, and so much more. So sign up at the icon tier now at patreon.com/poppantheon, or simply by clicking the link in the show notes of this episode. You won't regret it.
We have a question written in from Garrett, who is always such a thoughtful listener. Curious on your thoughts on the best way for artists to follow up a blockbuster hits-filled album. On the show, you've talked about albums like Prism or E equals MC squared being modest successes, but failing at the level of their prior albums and thus really feeling like underperformers. I then thought about how some artists kind of intentionally frame their follow-ups as more minor, like Scarlet or Positions from Doja Cat and Ariana Grande, and they are kind of then able to skate over the flop Bionic titles because they are not presented as a magnum opus pop record designed to compete with their previous works. Mm. I'm wondering if you think there is a right strategy, especially in the conversations that you've had about whether Guts is a success.
Great question. I think right off the bat, I would say that there is no right strategy. I think, like, unfortunately, if there was a right strategy, there would be everybody doing that right strategy and it would be like Bible. I don't think there's a right strategy, because so much of this has to do with so many weird factors. Like, why was the first album a blockbuster? Like, was it something that was built to over a long career where the artist already has, like, a really sturdy sort of building fan base that then just kind of crests in this moment, like Thank You Next was? Is it kind of like a rival on the scene that comes out of nowhere, like The Fame was? Like, there's all these different, like, versions of the blockbuster album that, like, create, I think, like, different problems for the follow-up. And then the question is, like, how far after is the follow-up? Like, is the follow-up something that there's a 5-year gap between that and the follow-up? Is the follow-up something that's coming 6 months or a year afterwards? That creates different circumstances. You know, there's extra musical circumstances that can affect, like, how the pop star's narrative changes between the blockbuster and the follow-up. I think the main answer here is that it's incredibly hard to follow up a blockbuster. I mean, you could say, like, Sweetener and Thank You Next was an interesting example of, like, would you consider Sweetener to be a blockbuster?
No, I consider Thank You Next to be a blockbuster.
Yeah, agree. So maybe that isn't the right example. Are there any examples that come to mind to you of, like, someone having a blockbuster and then having another blockbuster? I mean, I think Off the Wall Thriller Bad feels like a cycle of blockbusters, but at the time, Bad was seen as, even though it was a massive success with 5 number one singles that sold, like, you know, a shitload of albums, 30 million albums or something like that, it was still seen as a commercial come down from Thriller, because, like, what wouldn't seem like? So I'm trying to think, like, what are examples? I mean, True Blue and Like a Prayer, good examples of, like, kind of back-to-back blockbusters, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, if you're going to take that as your example, it's like you have one album that's like the most dead bullseye pure pop version of everything she'd been building to that point, just like a murderer's row of like classic singles. And then you have Like a Prayer that like doesn't lose the pop sensibility, but adds like more depth and like autobiography and stuff like that. So like maybe that's like an interesting, like that balance between like getting more personal, but like retaining the pop sensibility. I mean, you could say that about a number of albums, I think, that have like followed up blockbusters successfully. So maybe that's like a one too that really makes sense. But yeah, I don't know. I think there isn't really, like, what are good examples in your mind of like a blockbuster followed by another blockbuster?
So apologies for using her as an example again, but The Blueprint, I would go from Control
and Rhythm Nation. Yeah.
Janet,
yeah.
And then following that string of albums, the biggest of which was Janet. It sold 14 million worldwide. Into the Velvet Rope, an album that is what I personally consider to be a creative peak.
It yeah, but
is
not a blockbuster. A swing,
not a blockbuster, yeah. But that doesn't matter because it turns her career in a direction where she is thought of differently.
Right.
She is received her artistic point of view and contribution to music and culture, as opposed to just being received as a commercial hitmaker.
Right. Yeah. And that's what Garrett was sort of saying. Like,
yes, Garrett's observation is really smart.
One example, like one way to do this is to not try. It's like the Born in the USA into Nebraska trajectory, where it's like you kind of purposely make like a smaller feeling, more intimate record that like doesn't have the scope and ambition of being the blockbuster, the Positions vibe as well. Like, I think honestly, if I was going to say a smart, like if you were going to do the cautious, smarter thing, I think that would almost be the cautious, smarter thing. Because otherwise you have kind of the reputation situation where it's like you're going for something that's clearly grand scale, even grander scale than the previous blockbuster, but like there's absolutely no way it will be as successful as the previous blockbuster, or it's very unlikely. Or even like Born This Way. I mean, Born This Way and Reputation feel similar to me in the sense that successful.
They're still maximalist.
Yeah, super maximalist, like really going for it with the follow-up, but like just kind of very little chance that they were ever going to match the critical success. And also like successful albums, and also albums that have like continued to be loved, you know, and seen differently past their peak. But upon reception, I think were seen as disappointments. Yeah, this is hard. I don't think there really is an answer. I think because then I was also thinking about like Rihanna's string of albums, but it's like Rihanna never had like a classic. Like, would you call any of Rihanna's albums blockbusters? Like, I guess Girl Gone Bad was kind of a blockbuster.
I mean, 7 albums in 7 years.
It's more like the entire run was a blockbuster.
That thing is a blockbuster.
Right,
yeah.
Like, not
Auntie is sort of the Velvet Rope.
Yeah, but yeah. And she was never really like an albums artist or an album selling artist. I mean, so she's kind of hard to talk about in this way. It was like one continuous era for like 7 years. So yeah, I think it's really, really hard. And I do think as Garrett got it, I think Garrett had the smartest answer, which is like one smart solution is to not try. I think one smart solution is to not try, and then maybe have the next album after that be more of like something big, like Eternal Sunshine feels like, even though Eternal Sunshine is also kind of a small album, like it was rolled out more like a big album. And I think it's like paid off. She's had 2 number one singles. Like it seems like it's, you know, doing pretty well. So maybe one strategy is like quickly release a smaller sounding thing that kind of like takes the pressure off of the follow-up, and then spend some more time working on like the next one potentially being like another big deal album. I'd be curious for anybody who's listening, like, to put in the comments or whatever, go in Discord and let us know like what you think have been successful, like blockbuster to blockbuster mm-hmm. follow-ups.
Yeah. Great question.
Yes.
Always love to hear from Garrett. Yes. Do you have any thoughts on the Guts part of the question? How we contextualize its success?
I think Guts falls into the Reputation Born This Way paradigm, where it was like definitely a swing at a similar level of blockbuster success to the first record and like is almost there, like is not a failure, but isn't as successful as the first record, obviously, right?
I'm bouncing back and forth all the time on Olivia, and I just saw that every single song from Guts has now been on the Hot 100.
Yeah, but that's more of a function of like any artist that's
the
like
streaming,
Z like zeitgeisty artist. Like if they debut an album, they all get on the Hot 100. I don't think that's necessarily.
But like the tour is a big success.
Yeah, but so was the Born This Way Ball, and so was the Reputation Stadium tour. Like these, like I think that that's just more of like a.
Well, if she is continuing on the trajectory of either of those artists, then that is the best case scenario for mm-hmm. Olivia Rodrigo. So
I think Olivia's going to be fine. I think Guts. Yeah. What did Andrew Unterberger said at Gratz? He was like, this album is just successful enough to not be a failure, but like not the sort of like endless hit parade that Sour was, for sure. Which is also true of Born This Way, which is also true of Reputation. Like very similar trajectories. Like Reputation, like you wouldn't look at that as a failure. It sold a million copies in its first week. It had a couple top 10 hits. It had another, you know, couple radio hits. So it wasn't like a failure, but it wasn't producing 3 number one singles and 5 top 5 one singles and like dominating the conversation in the same way. So it's like similar, I think, trajectory.
Yeah. By all measures, Guts is a success, except in comparison to Sour.
Right, which is like the conundrum of the question, I think, in some ways.
The
like,
thing.
How
yeah.
do you do that? Yeah. Did Beyonce just do it? I mean, that's one question. A, do we consider Renaissance a blockbuster? Maybe not quite.
Maybe not quite.
Yeah. All right, anyway.
A question from Daniel wondering, do we have any irrational pop pet peeves? For some reason, I cringe when a song mentions a songwriting process, the song itself, or similar terms. For example, I'm obsessed with Ariana's Bye off the new album, but the line in the bridge where she says, this hook feels too hard to sing, always throws me off.
All right, well, I know yours, and I know you are. I already told you this, and you're going to quibble, but Russ definitely has one because he doesn't think it's irrational, but I think it's slightly irrational, and then you can call me out if you want to. But Russ's biggest pet peeve is when a lead single from an album is like a red herring that like doesn't reflect the rest of the album, and particularly when that lead single is a dance song that he thinks is gonna make the album be dancey, and then the album is not dancey. That is like Russ's like kryptonite. And I'm not just talking about like he's like, oh, I wish there was more dancey songs. He's like, I fucking hate this album, torch this to the ground, like I literally despise this artist, like I hope they burn in hell. Like it's like literally like a vitriol that like flies in the face of every Canadian stereotype that you've ever heard, like just comes spewing out of Russ like a geyser when that happens. It's like really funny. It's one of your funniest quirks, I think.
It takes three to make a trend. So what are the three times that I have done this?
Eternal Sunshine.
Great.
You were apoplectic about Eternal Sunshine. Like one of the angriest I've ever seen you.
I accept.
Troye Sivan's Something to Tell Each Other.
Quibbles, but go ahead.
What are the quibbles? You were so upset about that.
I don't know that I was so upset about that. I think that if one goes back and listens to our conversation about Searching for Queer Utopias on Troye Sivan, that I had a lot of positive things to say, but that record took some time to land on me because of how the pre-release music sounded and how he spoke about the record. But ultimately, I think that I settled into that album. And listen, this gives whiplash.
No, but I'm saying, it's like,
it's rational to get whiplash from this.
And then
what's your third example?
Tate McRae.
Oh, that is so fair on my part. Come on. That is absolutely fair on my part. She came out and slayed some singles, and then the rest of that album was like sad girl pop. I'm allowed to feel that way. How dare you?
How'd you feel about Melodrama in that regard?
I liked Melodrama more than a lot of people, and I saw her play that album in France.
Were you disappointed? Were you disappointed like when you heard Greenlight be like a dance song, and then like not really getting that?
No, because I didn't have a reasonable expectation that Lorde was going to become a dance artist.
What did you think about Honey, Robin's Honey, like when you heard Missing You and like then the album came out?
I thought that it was an incredibly adult approach to making dance music, electronic music, and I thought that it was a study in emotionality that a huge impact on
me. But you weren't disappointed that there weren't like 10
I wasn't disappointed whatsoever. No.
Okay, fine. In fact,
I was impressed that Robin was able to do something that was so emotionally resonant and in match the depth of the more youthful feelings that I think are easier to go deep on songs like Call Your Girlfriend.
Do you think I have peeves?
We all have peeves.
Yeah.
I think you need to do some self-investigation and therapy.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of peeves, I have to say. I hate when pop stars like complain about like paparazzi narratives about or like tabloid narratives about them. I think that's like real, unless they do it like really smartly, like Britney on Piece of Me or something. But like for the most part.
Or Lindsay on Rumors.
Yeah. Honestly, yes.
Yeah.
I don't like that. I don't like pop stars that can't rap trying to rap.
Mm.
Like Madonna on American Life, for instance. That's a pet peeve of mine. I'm sure I could like think more.
Pet peeves have more to do with how pop stars talk about, frame, and market their music than the things that happen within the confines of the music itself.
Yeah, I
hate when pop stars say that it's their most personal album to date.
Yes, right.
I hate when pop stars trash their previous work. There's lots of tropes in pop music marketing that really bother me. I'm a huge Lady Gaga fan, and I absolutely hate the way that Lady Gaga has spoken about her music, basically like Joanne forward.
But it's also kind of camp.
It is kind of. Well, eventually it became funny and fun, but more so in how off the wall she became when she started to talk about herself as an actor in that process. That spun us into
crazy.
The point of like cuckoo bananas in a way that is
but I what,
now
that.
Delightful again. Yeah, it, yeah. Now I'm delighted by
it. She's always been like that. Like she, like I'll never forget like in like the Fame era, she would like talk about Love Game as if she had written the next great American parable. Like, and it was like, and she,
which
like,
she did. I bought it all the way up until that pink
she'd be
cowboy
like talking
hat.
She'd be talking about it as if it was like this like Oxford University thesis on like queer representation and sexuality, and then the lyrics would be like, let's have some fun, this beat is sick, I want to take a ride on your disco stick.
Listen, I spent some time in academia, and there are a lot of theses about that era of Lady
I'm
Gaga.
Sure there are, but the way that she spoke about them like didn't really like resonate as like particularly whatever. Anyway, go on. I'm sure I could think of 20 million more. I'm always complaining all the time, but those are just some ones that pop into my head.
Drop your favorite of Louis's pet peeves in the comments.
Right. I bet you everybody listening to this
everybody
knows
who listens to the show
yeah,
has a list of 10 in their phone.
Yeah. Yes, right.
If you had to choose a job in pop music other than host or producer of a podcast, or in your case, DJ, what would you choose? This question comes from Busy.
Is it something I can do? Like, I don't, like, I can just pretend I have talents that I don't have?
Yeah. Yes, I think so.
Oh, definitely like producer, songwriter.
Mm.
I would love to be like Max Martin. I think that sounds like to be able to like sit down with somebody and like have the ability to like make incredible music and write pop songs. Like, I'd love to be able to do that. I also would love to be able to sing.
Mm.
One of my greatest sadnesses is like, I truly have a terrible voice. Like, Jack is a great singer. Like, Jack went to school and studied jazz voice and like is an amazing singer. And he has to like, I don't let it stop me. Like, I still sing all the time, but like, I'm truly terrible. And I just think having a great voice, and like, I don't want to say just sing, like, I want to have like Adele, Mariah, peak Mariah vocals, because not only because like that would just be fierce, but also because it feels really like emotionally cathartic. Like, I can only imagine like how it feels to like excavate your pain in that particular way. And I envy that people can do that. And I just like can't.
I love that your answer is, oh, I'd actually like to be one of the top three vocalists of all time.
Well, what do you want?
Cool.
That's my answer. What about you? Like, would you like to like be like an A&R director or something like that?
In the old school format of A&R, that is definitely one thing that I thought about. The idea of going to shows, spotting talent, sort of like casting, but for music, digging into scenes and figuring out who are interesting people. The pairing of an artist and producer or songwriter, giving suggestions from a label to the team or being on the team and suggesting, hey, I think this would be a cool cool collaborator for you. How about you listen to this, that kind of mm-hmm. thing.
How about tour director? You're so into like visuals and stuff like that, I feel like.
Absolutely. Probably though, creative director or fashion stylist really my dream. In my university days, I did like a couple gigs doing some real small time fashion styling and creative directing. And I love that kind of thing.
That's very your shit. Yeah.
However, I also think that I would make an absolutely kick-ass personal assistant.
Yeah, I can definitely concur with that.
All right, Jack's call.
Okay, let me get him.
Baby, Jack.
All right, Jack's here. Should we do this?
Yes. Hi, Jackery.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, we are going to bring on boyfriend to the show, Jack, adorable and wonderful young man, apparently a trained jazz singer. If you listen to every episode of All Access, he's been on at least once, maybe twice. But Jack, I think that this is your main feed debut. You are a real character in the background of all of my calls with Louie. I love to see you just like quietly working away on your laptop in the background of one of my Zoom sessions. Mm-hmm. Just a sweet and adorable young man. Hi, Jack. Welcome to the main feed of Pop Pantheon.
Hi. Boyfriend of the show. Wow.
I'm just going to, let me tell you, when I played this call, which I like did not know was going to make reference to Jack in front of Jack, like it just, the email came in and I played it and he was ready to respond, which is why he's here.
All right. Ready. Seated and ready. Let's play it for the listeners.
Seated and ready.
Hi, Louie. Hi, Russ. Happy Aries season from this Aries who turns 26 on the 26th. Speaking of my age, Louie, I know that I'm around the same age as your boyfriend, and I want to mention that because when I was 6 years old in 2004, I not only knew Jessica Simpson and Ashley Simpson songs, but I was singing them at the top of my lungs, like With You, La La, and Pieces of Me. Like, I annoyed the hell out of my older sisters who introduced me to that music and my parents. Which is to say, I don't really get the whole generational thing that you mentioned in that episode, because I'm what would be considered early Gen Z, and I was there for it. I remember Newlyweds, I remember Ashley Simpson's show, I don't remember the SNL debacle, but I was definitely there, and I definitely remember it, so I'm not sure why your boyfriend wouldn't. Maybe it's because I'm mid-20s and he's early 20s, but I'm kind of curious to see what his journey into pop culture discovery was like, and how it might be different from yours or Russ's, because mine was basically as soon as I could speak, mostly owing to my older sisters. And lastly, just to unhinge this question, am I crazy for thinking that the modern day equivalent to Jessica Simpson is Addison Rae? I saw Mila Tequila tweet the same thing once, and I'd be really interested to hear the two of you get into the weeds about it, as well as maybe seeing who the modern day Ashley equivalent would be as well.
Wait, I have a question before Jack responds. In what world is Jessica Simpson and Addison Rae the same? I don't understand this.
I don't know. The person that he is referring to tweeting about this, Mila Tequila, is a long-form video essayist who has really interesting ideas. So I am curious if there is a real explanation behind that.
That doesn't like immediately like ring true to me.
No, certainly not to me either.
Okay, good.
I'm confused by that. But Jack, how would you like to respond as a person in your early 20s?
No, he's not. They're the exact same age, first of all.
I don't even know if there was a question in there, but I mean, listen, I 100% knew who she was. Like, it wasn't like I have no clue who this person is. I definitely watched Dukes of Hazzard. I definitely caught a couple episodes of Newlyweds. I was aware of her as a like pop culture figure. I just didn't know her like music. Maybe I'm the like odd man out. I mean, I got a degree in music business and I'm pretty culturally aware. I don't know. I guess I preferred to listen to real singers.
Oh!
Just kidding.
Jack, I have two follow-up questions for you.
Please.
Did you have somebody in your life who primarily introduced you to things, either an older sibling or an older sibling figure, an aunt or an uncle? Where did you get the pop culture ahead of you from as a young person?
Yeah, I think it was definitely my siblings. So I'm the youngest of four, and all of my siblings are 7, 8 years older. So I think they definitely played a huge part in my like pop culture references. I mean, also, I definitely knew who her sister is, Ashley, because of that. It was on SNL, right? Of that performance. Yes. Like, I will never forget that ever. To kind of answer your question, definitely my older siblings played a big part in what kind of music I was listening to, because my parents were not really hip to much. So I think, yeah, definitely my older siblings. I was also someone who like sought it out too. I mean, I've been in love with music since I could talk, as our listener also stated.
Jack, while we have you, since this listener also called Louie and I old, perhaps rightfully so, will you answer a couple other Gen Z questions?
Of course.
Okay, this is a similar question that we got on Patreon from Aster, who asked whether it's possible to be in different tiers based on generation. He writes, as someone in Gen Z, Ariana Grande is clearly tier two. She has probably twice the amount of songs people know or like than Katy Perry or Gwen Stefani, and putting them all in the same tier feels wrong. Do you have a sense, as a younger person than Louie and I, any episode that you have listened to and been like, what are they talking about when it comes to the tier ranking?
Yes. Yes, but it's just because I'm so like biased. I feel like I would do such a bad job at this because I think I let my own biases kind of get in the way, whereas like you guys do such a good job at staying very objective.
Not everyone thinks that.
Seriously. But I don't know. I feel like it gets tricky if you add in the like generational factor, because I feel like part of what makes so many of these artists tier one or tier two is because they have been in the game for so long. It's like, yes, I feel like Ariana Grande is one of, if not the main pop girl of right now, but I don't know if that should qualify her to be higher in the like tier system, because she hasn't really built up a like long lasting legacy yet, if that makes sense. Yeah, I don't know if like generationally, if that should kind of play into where artists are tiered.
All right, I agree.
One final Gen Z question coming from Andrew, please defend your generation. Does Gen Z lack cultural literacy?
And you have to answer for the entire generation.
I would say yes. I mean, I feel like Generation Z is just not as eager to like look back and like get into the like weeds of some of these, I don't even know if you call them like legacy artists, but just I'm way more fascinated by 90s artists than I am Addison Rae's of the world. It doesn't make it good or bad. I think it's just generationally, we're like a little bit lazy. I feel like things are so accessible, and maybe it's the amount that we take in is so oversaturated that it's just hard to do that kind of like research. Yeah, I think it's a little just like laziness.
He's currently like literally going like diva to diva right now and listening to like, he's doing like what I do, but just like for fun. Like he's done like, how, who have you done? You've done Kylie, Janet, Madonna, Beyonce. Who else? I feel like you've been on like a tear.
That might be Mariah.
Mariah, Whitney.
So I have a more sympathetic answer to this and what is going on generationally. I teach Gen Z younger than you, sort of 18 to 21. And I find it fascinating what reaches them and what doesn't. And I think a lot of what doesn't because you were the first generation to receive pop culture via algorithms that are personalized to you, which leaves a lot out in terms of what has come before. Whereas millennials grew up with MTV and VH1 and all these cable programs, episodes and reruns. We learned about the culture of the past from readily available resources, where the culture that is fed to you is really personalized and designed for you and often doesn't include some of the stuff.
That is so true. I mean, we have like award shows, but it's just not the same. I think you're right. Like, our feeds are like curated to like what we like and what we know. And I feel like it never really like forces us to kind of push beyond that.
I also want to say that I don't feel it's at all shameful that Jack didn't know Jessica fucking Simpson music. Like, are you kidding me? Those songs, like, I think there's people our age who couldn't name Jessica Simpson songs or like could name like one.
Or maybe know her as like the woman with the Daisy Dukes with or something.
And the tuna.
Yeah. Tuna. Or the good shoes.
Yes.
Jack, thank you so much for indulging us and answering this listener's question and all of my insane follow-up questions that I know we did not prepare you for.
No, love it. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, baby. Okay, well.
Well.
That was fun.
That was a load of fun. Thank you so much to everybody who sent in a question, a voice note. We'd love to hear your voices.
We're going
to
be answering more of these questions on Patreon,
if your
right?
question is not answered yet, it still might be. Sign up for our Patreon or go to Apple. If you are listening there now, you can now subscribe to us on your device inside the Apple podcast environment. So hit the subscription.
Okay, so Russ, what's your favorite Jessica Simpson song that we could send the podcast out on?
The cover of These Boots Are Made for Walking.
I knew you were going to say it. I literally knew you were going to say that. Is that because of Yaya? Okay, fine. Let's go out on Jessica Simpson's cover of Nancy Sinatra's These Boots Are Made for Walking from the fucking Dukes of Hazzard soundtrack.
An irresistible song.
Yes. Oh, God. All right. Bye, Russ. These boots are made for I'm gonna walk all over you.